Have you ever found yourself asking why alcohol plays such a big role across so many cultures? Striking a balance between moderation and excess isn't just a modern struggle. It goes back to ancient Egypt, Mesopotamia, and the Roman Empire. I'm Lauren, and I'm a postdoctoral fellow in Egyptology at the University of Oxford. I'm fascinated by how today's issues mirror the past, from ancient health warnings to peer pressure at Greek symposia. We're exploring it all. Join me as we get drunk on history and uncover the timeless truth behind our drinking habits. Hi there, and welcome to another episode of Drunk on History. This time we are going to the Roman Empire. It is my pleasure to introduce Emlyn Dodd, who until recently was a senior lecturer in classical studies at the Institute of Classical Studies at the University of London, but has now moved to Australia, to the University of Adelaide. He co-directs the Falleri Novi project, including major excavations at the Roman urban center of Falleri Novi in central Italy, and he has widely published Vine Growing, Wineries, and Wine Production in the Roman World. So, Emlyn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Lauren. It's great to be here.
To start off, the Roman Empire, of course, covers a very large geographical area. Roman history also spans a very large time period, going from the kings through the republic to the empire that then also kept on expanding. So for our listeners, could you provide us with a little bit of a short geographical and temporal background to the Romans, which is a very large question, I know, but maybe some time frame and geography will help our listeners to settle in.
Sure. I think the most important thing to know in relation to what we're talking about today, wine, is that wine is something that started long before the Romans, of course, thousands of years before the Romans, but it was really in this Roman period where we see some interesting developments taking place. And for that, we're kind of talking the mid-first millennium BCE, so about 500 BCE onwards. And then the Roman period kind of continues in various forms all the way through till about 500 CE. Lots of people, of course, would argue that it continues a lot longer than that for various reasons. But what we're interested in today is really that kind of thousand-year period from the Republic and its various iterations all the way through to the Empire and late antiquity.
Thank you so much. To maybe actually dive into the topic, let us maybe start with a quote, namely that beer is for barbarians and wine is for the real Romans. Is this true, and where does this quote actually come from?
It's a really interesting notion. And of course, it's, again, something that goes back much further than the Romans. The Greeks, this kind of classical Greek culture that we're also familiar with, was renowned for priding themselves on drinking diluted wine and kind of using this to have very philosophical, sensible conversations and not drink too much wine. Whereas the barbarians in this Greek period, the so-called barbarians, would drink their wine neat and would get very drunk and would act out because of that. And the Romans, whether they took this up directly or took this up for their own kind of purposes, continued this habit in some ways of priding themselves on being very civilized and drinking wine, whereas other beverages like beer or mead or even milk in some parts of the world were considered barbarous and only drunk by others, not real Romans. So it's definitely a notion that existed, but I would say it's also a notion that was kind of touted and spread by the social elite. And that's what comes to us through the source material. This is very much something that's getting spread by the elite members of Roman society much more than probably the everyday people. I'm not sure this is something that they would have thought about and would have kind of connected with as much as those higher up in society.
Thank you so much. So let's talk wine, because we have plenty of sources for wine in the Roman Empire. Just to pick one, we have Pliny the Elder giving this very nice overview in his Historia Naturalis, describing wines made from grape, fig, apple, olive, also hybrid varieties. So which kinds of wine did actually exist in the Roman world, and which were most common, and how did they sort of distinguish between the different qualities of all of these different kinds of wines?
Pliny is this tremendous source and provides so much detail and an astonishing amount of detail that we perhaps wouldn't even expect to find in relation to wine and vine growing in the ancient world 2,000 years ago. And he, as you say, talks about all these different types of wine made from all different sorts of things, and then with all sorts of other things added to them after they're made into beverages that transform them in entirely new ways. So he goes into an enormous amount of detail about all these sorts of things, as well the process of making it and the process of cultivating vineyards too. So it's an absolutely crucial source to our understanding. He talks about wines made from grapes, which are, of course, what we know of most of the time as wine today. But he also talks about wines made from other fruits, but these were probably more common in only particular regions of the Mediterranean. The usual grape wine was certainly the most common and most widespread and dominant and widely drunk across the Roman Mediterranean world and up into Central Europe and over the Middle East. So that was certainly the most common type. But within that category of grape wine, there were also many different types. There were sweet wines, there were bitter wines, there were very tannic rich wines, there were lighter, very low alcohol wines. So there was, again, a whole diversity of wine types just made from grapes. And Pliny also talks about these, as do other sources, but it's very difficult for us as archaeologists or ancient historians to understand which of these types of wine were the most common. Some people have tried to untangle it, but it's really, really challenging for us to kind of detect at that level of detail and granularity. We think that in some periods, or we know, in fact, in some periods that some types of wine were much more common than others, but that changed over time. So it's kind of like our modern wine marketplace, where tastes change, wine types change, preferences change over time, and you know, things come into popularity and things go out of popularity. And this was true for the Roman world too.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating that they just went already so far with like trying out all of these hybrid varieties, because as you already mentioned, they often also added certain ingredients which we would probably not add into our wines nowadays, including like honey and herbs, which are a little bit more common, I would say. But I've read that in some cases they also added seawater to the wine. Why?
So they did this for all sorts of reasons, we think. Of course, we don't have a hard answer, but we think they were doing it for all sorts of reasons. Part of it might have been because a good deal of the wine that they were making was pretty bad. It was quite vinegary and wasn't necessarily what we would consider a nice wine to drink these days. So maybe they were adding all these different flavors to change and modify the flavor to make it more palatable and enjoyable for them to drink. But we also think that they probably noticed a side effect or a benefit to adding these sorts of things in terms of preserving the wine and stabilizing the wine, which of course now with modern science we know those kind of detailed chemical properties behind all of this and what we need to add to a wine to make it last longer and not turn into vinegar. The Romans didn't have that level of knowledge, but they probably noticed what was happening to wines when they added these sorts of things to it, and then that kind of turned into a habit and aspect of their process. So when they were adding the herbs and the spices and those sorts of things, they were maybe doing it to modify flavor or to create wines for particular purposes. Whereas they were also adding resins and pitches from tree, often to waterproof the inside of the ceramic containers that the wines were in. But these sorts of products, as well as sulfur and seawater, also help to stabilize and preserve the wine and make it last a bit longer. When they're shipping it all across the Mediterranean from one region to another region, it has to kind of last through those journeys and last through the marketplace and sale before it's even consumed. So it was quite an important step for them to at least serendipitously realize whether they knew the science behind it or not. The other thing that's really interesting that we have evidence of in our sources, Columella in particular, a writer in the first century CE, talks about adding even more bizarre things that we certainly wouldn't consider today necessarily, adding gypsum or plaster into wines to correct deficiencies in things like acidity. So this is really starting to dive into modern wine sommelier kind of territory where you're trying to, and then winemaking territory where you're trying to adjust the levels of acidity in your wine to make a more palatable product. And the Romans were aware of all of these things, and they knew of techniques to adjust the flavor and the profile of wine to make it more palatable and more marketable in their shops.
I think it's fantastic that they already went so far with their knowledge of how, like, which ingredients actually altered the taste of wine. Which brings me to my following question. Who was actually able to make wine? Was this possible for everyone? If you owned a vineyard, you could simply start making and selling your wine, or were the vineyards owned by different people than the ones making the wines and owning the wineries, or how did this exactly work?
It's a really good question, and it's something that we have some evidence for, certainly in regions like Egypt, where we have very detailed accounts from papyrus, for example, that go into extraordinary levels of information about who owned the vineyards, who owned the wineries, who was the kind of agent and merchant, and who was the winemaker. So we have really, really good data for those places. But then other places like Italy, for example, we have good information for the wealthier landowners, often, who owned enormous areas of vineyards and had big villas that they were making wine in. But we have much less information for the sort of everyday person or everyday farmer that might have been making wine as well. So we know that these very wealthy landowners owned huge tracts of vineyards all across the Mediterranean. We know that they owned production facilities and then used wine as a really key source of income. It was quite a lucrative business if you were good at it, the wine industry in the Roman period. But we also have an increasing amount of evidence now for everyday people who were making wine in Roman towns and cities at a much smaller scale. They were producing probably for their household, for consumption, and also maybe selling a little bit of surplus out on the street in a taberna or a shop. So there's all sorts of different levels of society making wine. And there are also differences in gender participation for this process too, because we have very good evidence for male domination of the winemaking process. We've got lots of evidence for males being involved in treading grapes and working presses and working in wineries. And we have very little evidence for women or females being involved in these particular roles, which is interesting to kind of think about in terms of who was involved in the production itself. Whereas if we look in the fields, in the cultivation of vineyards and the harvesting of grapes, this seems like a much more balanced playing field. We've got good evidence for women and children and men and all kind of segments of the population participating and working in those activities. So it seems like maybe there was a bit of a difference between the actual making of wine and who was involved in that versus the kind of cultivation of vines and the harvesting of vines.
You already mentioned as well that there were like also the bigger estates. And now I'm also more specifically thinking about the imperial estates, including also vineyards belonging to the Roman emperor. So how did this work? And how does wine coming from these larger imperial estates compare to the more local wine made by the local farmers? This wine from this imperial estates have more prestige, for example. And in this context, you may also mention a little bit about the imperial winery at the Villa of the Quintili, where they even have fountains with wine, which I found absolutely fascinating to read about.
It's true that the imperial court and the emperor themselves owned enormous amounts of land, of course, and much of this was dedicated to vineyards, and they used wine, again, just like other people in the Roman world, as a source of income for the imperial family and household. The interesting kind of angle on this is that the emperor and the imperial court tried to leverage their wine production to make it more popular or more profitable oftentimes. And we hear particular cases, for example, down in Campania, so around Pompeii or nearby Pompeii, the region there. We know that Augustus owned lots of estates and started making wine around there. And then this turned into quite a popular type of wine. And that whole region then started becoming quite popular for the wine that was made there. So the emperor kind of leveraged his ownership of estates there to start trying to make a little bit more money and to increase the popularity of the products that were coming out of there. So there were certainly lots of imperial estates making good money and making a good deal of wine off it. And then, as you mentioned, we have these slightly more unusual instances where it's not just an imperial estate or winery making wine for the sake of making wine or making wine for the sake of making money, but they're doing it maybe for slightly more unusual cultural or social reasons. And that case of the Villa of the Quintili is a fascinating one, because we see there in the winery, it's this amazing, unique winery, which we think is built for the purpose of spectacle. It's built for a kind of theatrical function. There's not just production spaces to make wine in the very practical sense of making wine, but there's also this sense of theatre with fountains of wine, with areas for spectators to recline and dine while people work and make wine in front of them as a sort of performance. So there's this fantastic kind of dramatic aspect towards winemaking in this particular facility, which is located just outside of Rome on the Via Appia Antica. And here we think that maybe the emperor and the imperial court were involved in making wine as a sort of religious occasion or a sort of ritual event, perhaps linked to something like the opening of the harvest. We know that the emperor at this particular time of Roman imperial history took on this role of priest to open the harvest. So perhaps this is a facility that played a particular role in that sort of ritual landscape that surrounded wine and the agricultural calendar too.
In addition to this ritual landscape that you're talking about, when would wine have typically been consumed? And there must have also been a lot of banquets and a lot of other social occasions during which the Romans were drinking wine. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
I think the short answer to this is that wine permeated almost every aspect of society. It was drunk in banquets or in feasts and kind of celebratory occasions, in convivia, these household drinking kind of events that were slightly more low-key than feasts. But it was also used in religion as a kind of libation or offering. It was used in funerary ritual. It was used in medicine. It was used in cooking. So it was found everywhere. It was used in all sorts of ways, perhaps even more so than we do today. So it really kind of permeated every aspect of society and daily life.
Yeah, wine was really very, very present in the Roman Empire. And to maybe go a little bit back to how wine was actually made, could you give a short overview of the cultivation and production techniques that were involved in wine? Because you needed presses, you needed fora to store the wine, to ferment the wine, but what else would you have needed?
So a lot of the process of making wine in the Roman period is fairly familiar to us if you know anything about viticulture and winemaking today. Of course, there's been lots of technological change, especially since the Industrial Revolution, but a lot of the general process is fairly similar. So grapevines were cultivated in the field. They were trained in a whole range of different ways, some of which look fairly similar to what we do today and some of which were a little bit different. And of course, then they were harvested once a year during the annual harvest in kind of late summer. And from there, grapes would have been transported relatively quickly into the wineries, which took lots of different forms. It might have been a big villa. It might have been a very basic facility tucked behind someone's house in a town, or it might have been a facility out in the fields in a very isolated rural context. But these facilities were where the grapes were transformed into must, so they could have been trodden. That was the first basic kind of process in antiquity and even up to much more recent times, where people simply just stamped and trod on grapes to extract the juice, and you can usually extract about 80% of the juice, so you get most of it out using this process. And after that, all of the pomace, the kind of leftovers of skins and juice and seeds and everything, would have been gathered up and placed in a range of sort of baskets or boxes or other devices and put under a press. And by the time we're in the Roman period, presses have developed into a variety of forms. Lots of them are large levers that are pulled down by a system of winches or other mechanisms. Some of them take the form of screws, so you could have a screw pressing directly down onto this mass of grapes, or you could have a lever driven down by a screw. And that was a particular innovation that we think occurred about the first century BCE / CE. And then in particular regions, there were other ways of processing grapes into wine. If we look at Egypt, for example, they have these amazing pictorial depictions of torsion presses where grapes would have been placed in a range of bags or textiles and then twisted to extract the juice. So there were very regional specific processes used too. And then after this, the must would have been collected and put in a range of different collection vats, big plaster-lined vats to keep them waterproof, or a range of ceramic containers. The most common was the dolium, the enormous kind of round clay jars, which were often buried in the ground to keep the temperatures nice and cool and consistent for fermentation. And after this, we're given very detailed instructions again by our ancient sources about how long to ferment the wine or what to do while it's fermenting. You need to skim it and you need to stir it every now and then, and then you need to put the lid back on, and very detailed kind of processes and instructions that they were aware of to try and create the best quality product. And even an awareness of things like aging wine once it's gone through its fermentation process. And a lot of this was done to try and extract more money, to try and make it into a more high value and marketable product, to bring in that income for the winemaker and farmer.
Yeah, there must have also been a lot of regional differences in how wine was actually made. You already mentioned that they were doing a little bit different in Egypt. Also, depending on the climate and the terrain, which of course, varied massively across the Roman Empire because it's just such a large geographical area. And I know in certain regions, especially in Gaul, there were these artificial heating rooms that were used. Could you tell us a little bit more about those?
Lots of different aspects of the production process change depending on the region, as you say, and depending on the climate and the weather and so on. So in those cooler regions like Gaul, like Central Europe, even Northern Italy around the Alps, fermentation didn't start as readily as it might have in the warmer climates and didn't kind of proceed as they wanted it to. So they created or they innovated these solutions to still enable and activate fermentation and produce the sort of wine that they wanted to produce. So they constructed in some of these cooler climates heated rooms that the wine would have been fermented in and stored in. Some of them included smoking facilities to provide a particular flavor into the wine, we think. And this, we hear through our sources, was received mixed reviews. Some people loved it, some people hated it. So those sorts of innovations existed. And then if we look elsewhere, back again to Egypt, for example, we can see that wine was fermented in amphorae, so these sort of smaller portable ceramic jars, and then put on the roof of buildings in the sun to again kickstart that fermentation process and create slightly different regional types of wine. So lots of different processes again, and a lot of it kind of does reflect back onto the particular climate or the particular weather that place experienced, adaptations that people there had to kind of enact when they were making wine.
So these innovations were very local, but would production techniques also have spread across the empire? Certain innovations in winemaking, starting in Italy, for example, and then spreading out, is that something that we can also see in the sources?
That's certainly true to an extent. The thing we have to be careful about that we get a good understanding of through the archaeological material is that innovations didn't just spread out evenly or in a linear fashion. We see some regions, we see an innovation occur and we see some regions taking it up because they wanted to for whatever reason. And then we see other regions ignoring it completely, even though they would have had access to it. So a lot of it seems to be down to the very local needs and context and resource availability and expertise of particular producers or regions, whether they took up these innovations. And one of the nicest examples, I think, is the screw press. And the screw was a major kind of technological innovation, lots of things, but also for winemaking. It enabled a whole different system of presses to be created, and this had benefits for different reasons. But the screw wasn't taken up everywhere. An enormous amount of quantity, enormous amount of wine was made from North Africa, for example, and we very rarely see the screw being taken up in production facilities in North Africa. Whereas if we look to Italy or to Greece, especially in late antiquity, screw presses are absolutely everywhere. And they're taken up by almost every producer. And Spain is the same, in fact. I think by the Roman imperial period, the screw press is the most dominant press by a long way in Spain. So it's interesting to see that these innovations occurred in particular regions, and they were very useful for some producers, but they weren't considered useful for all producers. Some producers just stuck with centuries-old technology, probably because it just did the job that it needed to do, and they didn't need to invest in these fancy new innovations.
In addition to all of these innovations spreading, there is, of course, also the larger picture of the actual winemaking and the spread of viticulture, which is one way or another kind of tied to the concept of Romanization. Because in many areas of the Roman Empire, such as, for example, the Iberian Peninsula, Spain, wine was already made before the Romans came. So what then changed with this concept of Romanization? Is it the scale of production that changed? Did they start making different kinds of wine, or what exactly happened there?
I really liked that you flagged that wine was already being made and already existed in lots of these regions that the Romans were invading and colonizing and conquering, because that's absolutely, absolutely right. And people think a lot of the time that the Romans were the ones, or the Greeks, or whoever were the ones to spread wine into all these new territories. But in fact, there are much deeper histories of wine in a lot of these Mediterranean and European regions. So while the Romans weren't necessarily introducing wine culture or winemaking, a lot of the time they were energizing it or kind of encouraging its production in slightly different ways or as you say, on different scales. We see, for example, in some parts of the Mediterranean, as the Roman Empire expands and as they colonize different regions, we see much larger scale wine production taking up and being kind of put in place. We see enormous villas in regions like Gaul and Hispania that simply weren't there before. They just weren't making wine on this scale before the Romans arrived. And this probably isn't necessarily just something that that they have the Romans to thank for. It's probably also a lot due to local people there that saw what was going on and that were kind of had enough agency to create this sort of thing based on the opportunity that they were given. So we shouldn't, I don't think, give all the credit to the Romans. I think there's probably a lot of local and indigenous creativity and agency that's going on there too, based on this new world that they found themselves in. But there was a certainly influence there by the Romans, and the scale is one big component of it. The other thing that's probably important to think about is that a whole diverse landscape of wines became opened up through the kind of late Republic and into the imperial period. We see an increasingly widespread range of grapevines being cultivated and types of grapes being cultivated, lots of hybridization going on, and the creation of more resilient or slightly different or adaptable grapevines in different regions because of this much more connected, much more kind of integrated world that the Roman Empire created in some ways. And also the creation of lots of different wine types that didn't exist before. Again, probably due to the fact that people are living in this slightly different context and landscape now, and they were maybe open to different ideas and different knowledge that perhaps they didn't have access to as easily before. So I think lots of different things changed, but really important to remember that much of this was going on before the Romans existed in these places. And it's only a few regions, the UK or Britain is a good example of this, where we think that the Romans were the ones to truly introduce viticulture and winemaking into. We don't have any evidence yet of vineyards or grapevines being grown in Britain before the Roman period. So we think they were the ones to bring it over, and they were the ones to kind of kickstart wine production locally in regions like that. But there's only a handful of them, so it's few and far between.
Yeah, I think it's indeed very important to point out that the Romans did not invent everything. But of course, as you already mentioned a little bit, the viticulture in the Roman Empire, which is probably one of the bigger changes, could be very commercial. It was also really supposed to be lucrative. People made wine to sell and to earn money. And a little bit like modern influencers, there were also people who were saying that, for example, Emperor Augustus liked their wine the best, which is, I think, a very fascinating and intriguing marketing strategy from the ancient world. And I wanted to ask you, is this something that you come across more often in the sources? Was this a general strategy? Was this an exception? And more importantly, would it have worked?
We can be sure, I think, that it absolutely worked, and our evidence certainly points to as much, that tastemakers, whether it was the emperor or other social elite or people connected to the emperor, were certainly able to influence the popularity and wine market. There's a really nice parallel that I have written about recently, which is in 17th century England, where a taste for champagne marked someone's proximity to the royal court. And then this started to impact trade patterns, and more champagne was shipped to wealthier regions with greater numbers of social elite that wanted to be connected more closely to the royal court. And I think there's a lot of this going on in the Roman world with specific types of prestigious or popular wines that people wanted to be connected to because it reflected positively on them, and it reflected that they had a connection to higher levels of society. So we know that certainly the emperors and other members of the elite of Roman society acted as tastemakers in this way. They stimulated local economies purposefully and probably accidentally sometimes, and then all of that cascaded down and started to influence popularity and distribution, production patterns even of particular wine types. Like you say, there's this great example in Pliny the Elder who talks about the fact that Augustus preferred Cetian wine over all others. And then subsequent emperors also preferred that type of wine because they wanted perhaps to be connected to Augustus. So there's a really interesting angle there. And there were also people connected closely to the emperor. One of the most important, perhaps, in some ways, was the emperor's physician, the court physician. And there's good evidence, too, for these court doctors, imperial doctors, preferring certain types of wine for their health-giving qualities, for their kind of medicinal qualities, which then also impacted the wider population's use of these wines and reinforced that, oh, I should be using Cetian wine because it will make me healthier and it will make me live longer or whatever it might have been. So there were not just the emperor, but these sort of people in that world and connected to them that also were very active in promoting and trying to popularize certain types of wine.
Certain types of wine were really clearly hypes in the ancient world, which I think is absolutely fascinating. And I mean, the Romans clearly drank a lot of wine, were using it for medicinal purposes and so on. So it's very, very present in the society. But of course, the Romans were also known, same as the Greeks, for diluting their wine with water. They were supposed to drink wine in moderation. There is this very interesting inscription of a certain Tiberius Claudius Secundus from Pompeii stating that the baths, the wine, and the love ruin our body, but the baths, the wine, and the love also make life. So here again, we have this sort of contradictory view of the negative and the positive sides of alcohol, which was already very present in antiquity. And I wanted to ask you to finish up the episode if you have some examples that you could discuss, for example, classical authors urging for moderation to sort of, yeah, contradict this view of, the, you know, the Romans were constantly drinking wine, but there was more to it and there must have been a lot of urge for moderation as well.
Again, a lot of this goes back to different strata in society, I think, because the evidence that were given to us by these classical authors and by a lot of our other literary evidence is from one very particular segment of Roman society, often elite male kind of voices that are coming through to us there. So there's certainly one aspect or one segment of society that is in some way preaching moderation and trying to kind of give moralizing opinions and views around how you should drink wine and how you consume wine. But on the flip side, I think a lot of the rest of society may have been going about it in a slightly different way. I'm sure they would have connected themselves in some ways to perhaps that cultural habit, but there also would have been, as you say, a great deal of drunkenness and a great deal of drinking wine for the sake of drinking wine. And we've got good evidence for that too. The best, I think, or the most interesting aspect of this that comes through to us from some of our literary sources and our classical authors, but also the archaeological evidence, is that there was a really sharp distinction between what was the earlier Greek symposium or drinking party and the later Roman banquet or convivium. And in the earlier Greek symposium, the diluting of wine and the drinking of wine was very well controlled. It happened in a central cup and everyone drank the same diluted wine. Whereas in the Roman period, we see an evolution of this and everyone's mixing and drinking wine to their own kind of individual preference. They would mix it in their own cup and prepare and consume their own wine. So it seems much more individual in the Roman period. People are either diluting with water to different ratios or adding different things to their wine, which wasn't occurring in earlier periods. And the other contradiction to our urge for moderation by much of our classical literature is that in all of these Egyptian papyri and documentary sources that we have provide such amazing detail, the habit of mixing wine with water is mentioned almost nowhere. So there's no sort of clue in what was a significant part of the Roman world in Egypt was that mixing wine with water was occurring and that this sort of sense of moderation and avoiding drinking wine and getting drunk was really a thing. So, of course, this doesn't imply that everyone was drinking wine neat and they weren't diluting at all and it was a big fiesta all the time. But it's interesting that this is a complete gap in our evidence and there's no kind of connection between Egypt, which is so rich in source material in some ways, to these particular views that this particular segment of society are giving us. So I think we need to think about it quite carefully. Certainly some people and many of our classical authors, Martial, Pliny and so on, talk about how wine needs to be drunk in this very particular way. But we need to be careful about applying that to the entirety of the Roman world and to the entirety of society.
I think this is also an excellent way to end the episode. So I think we've learned that certain authors are urging for moderation because wine will ruin your body, as the text in Pompeii tells us, but it will also make life. And as always, it's important to balance it all out. And the Roman world is definitely a fascinating part of history to study when it comes to wine, from marketing strategies to immense temporal and geographical differences across the empire. So thank you so much, Emlyn, to get drunk on Roman wine with me.
Thanks very much, Lauren. It was a pleasure to be here.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Drunk on History. If you're thirsty for more tales from the ancient world, don't miss our next episode. It's full of even more drinking stories from past civilizations. Drunk on History is made in cooperation with the New Media Center of the University of Basel.